And there it was. The boys nodded. But how deep? Roberto prompted, after Hexter seemed to be taking a little nap. Hexter started upright and looked at the boys. The ship was built in 1763 and had 28 cannons, one of which they pulled up and put in Central Park, and only found out later it had a cannonball and gunpowder rusted inside it. They had to defuse it with a bomb squad. So anyway, 6th Raiders like that had a single deck, not that high off the water, about 10 feet. And the masts were still sticking out of the water, so that means it sank in something between 15 and, say, 40 feet. But the river isn't that deep so close to shore, so, say, 20 feet. Then they filled in that part of the river, but only a few feet higher than high tide, no more than 8 feet. And now sea level is said to be about 50 feet higher than back then, so what, you're hitting bottom at 40 feet down? More like 20, Stefan said. Okay, well, maybe the shore there was more built up than I thought. Anyway, the implication is that the chests will be 30 or 40 feet below the current bottom.
But the metal detector detected it, Stefan pointed out.
That's right. So, that suggests it's around 30 feet down.
So we can do it, Roberto declared. Stefan wasn't so sure.
I mean, we can, if we go back enough times, but I don't know if there's room for that much dirt under our diving bell. In fact, I know there isn't.
We'll have to circle the hole, move the dirt off in different directions, Roberto said. Or put it in buckets.
Stefan nodded uncertainly.
It would be better if we could get scuba gear and dive with that. Our diving bell is too small.
The old man regarded them, nodding in thought.
I might be able to...
The room lurched hard to the side, tumbling the stacks of books all around. The boys shrugged them off, but the old man was knocked to the ground by a stack of atlases. They threw these off him and helped him back to his feet, then went digging for his glasses, him moaning all the while.
What happened? What happened?
Look at the walls! Stefan said, shocked. The room itself now tilted like one of the remaining stacks of books, and through one bookshelf and its books they could see daylight, and the next building over.
We gotta get out of here,
Roberto told Mr. Hexter, pulling him upright.
I need my glasses, the old man cried. I can't see without them.
Okay, but let's hurry. The two boys crouched and threw books around carefully but swiftly until Roberto came upon the glasses. They were still intact. Hexter put them on and looked around.
Oh, no, he said. It's the building, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Let's hurry and get out of here. We'll help you down. Buildings in the drink collapsed all the time. It was a regular thing. The boys tended to scoff at the bad stories told about such collapses. But now they were remembering how Vlade always called the intertidal the Death Zone. Don't spend too much time in the Death Zone, he would say, explaining that that was what climbers called mountains above 20,000 feet. As the boys spent lots of time in the intertidal, and were now diving the river too, they tended to just agree with him and let it be, maybe considering themselves to be climbers at altitude. Tough guys. But now they were holding the old man by the elbows and hurrying him along the sideways tilted hall as best they could, then down the stairs, one step at a time, had to make sure he didn't fall or else it would take even more time, sometimes placing his feet by grabbing his ankles and placing them. The stairwell was all knocked around, railings down, open cracks in walls showing the building next door. Smell of seaweed and the anoxic stink of released mud, worse than any chamber pot. There was a booming from outside, and any number of shouts and bangs and other sounds. Shafts of light cut through the hazy air of the stairwell at odd and alarming angles, and quite a few of the stairs gave underfoot. Clearly, this old building could fall over any moment. The oozy stench filled the air, like the building's guts or something. When they got down to the canal-level doorway, now a parallelogram, very ugly to see,
They emerged onto the stoop dock to find that the canal outside was filled with brick and concrete rubble, wood beams, broken glass, crushed furniture, whatever. Apparently one of the 20-story towers on the next block had collapsed, and the shockwave of air, or the wave of canal water, or the direct impact of building parts, or some combination of all these, had knocked over a lot of smaller buildings. Up and down the canal, buildings were tilted or tumbled. People were still emerging from them, gathering dazedly on stoops or piles of rubble. Some pulled at these piles. Most just stood there looking around, stunned and blinking. The turbid canal water bubbled and was disturbed by any number of small wakes. Rats were swimming away. Mr. Hexter adjusted his glasses when he saw this and said,
"Fuck if it isn't rats leaving a sinking ship. I never thought I'd see that."
"Really?" Roberto said. "We see it all the time." Stefan rolled his eyes and suggested they get going somewhere. Then Hexter's own building groaned immensely behind them, and Stefan and Roberto picked up the old man by the elbows and moved him as fast as they could over the wreckage in the canal. They lifted him over impediments, huffing at his unexpected weight, and helped him through the watery sections, sometimes going thigh-deep but always finding a way. Behind them, the building was shrieking and groaning, and that gave them strength. When they got to the canal's intersection with 8th and looked back, they saw that Mr. Hexter's building was still standing, if that was the word for it. It was tilted more heavily than when they had escaped from it, and had stopped tilting only because it was propped by the building next to it, crushing the neighbor but not completely collapsing it. Hexter stood staring at it for a while.
"Now it's like I'm looking back at Sodom and Gomorrah," he said. "Never expected to do that, either."
The boys stood, holding the old man by the arms.
"You okay?"
Stefan asked him again.
"I suppose getting wet like this can't be good for us."
"We got a bottle of bleach in our boat. We'll spray you down. Let's catch the Vapo down to 23rd. We gotta get out of here."
Stefan said to Roberto,
"We're taking him to the Met?
What else can we do?"
They explained the plan to Mr. Hexter. He looked confused and unhappy.
"Come on," Roberto said. "We'll be fine."
"My maps!" Hexter cried. "Did you get my maps?"
"No," Roberto said. "But we have that GPS position on our pad."
"But my maps!"
"We can come back and get them later."
This didn't comfort the old man. But there was nothing for it but to wait for the Vaporetto and try to stay out of the rain, which luckily had reduced to a drizzle. They were about as wet as they could get anyway. From one area of the Vapo dock, they could see the immense pile of wreckage that marked the fallen tower. It appeared to have pancaked onto its lower floors and then tipped to the south, distributing the higher floors across 2 or 3 canals. People in boats had stopped right in the middle of 8th to stare at the collapse, causing a big traffic jam. It was going to take a while for the Vapo to make its way down to them. There were sirens in the distance, but there were always sirens in the distance. It wasn't clear that these sirens were in response to the collapse. Presumably, any number of people had been crushed and were lying dead in the wreckage of the tower, but none of them were visible.
"I hope we don't turn into pillars of salt," said Mr. Hexter.
"The skyscrapers of New York are too small," suggested Le Corbusier. "Widening income inequality is the defining challenge of our time. We find an inverse relationship between the income share accruing to the rich, top 20%, and economic growth. The benefits do not trickle down." Noted the International Monetary Fund. Years later.
H. Franklin. Jojo and I set up a chat box on our screens, and we didn't talk that much about business in it, although we did both follow some of the same feeds, because those were the feeds anyone needed in order to trade in coastal futures. Mostly, it was just a way to stay in touch, and it gave me a glow to see it there in the upper right-hand corner of my screen, and sometimes we did discuss some movement of interest in the biz. Like she wrote, Why is your IPPI dropping like this? A Chelsea tower melted just now.
It's that sensitive?
That's my index for you.
Braggart.
Are you shorting it now? Got to hedge, right? You think it will drop more? A little. At least until Shanghai brings it back up. Catch a wave meanwhile. Aren't you long on intertidal? Not so much. I thought ownership issues were clarifying. Intertidal isn't just ownership uncertain. Physical? Right. If ownership solidifies on properties that have melted, so what?
Ah, that's factored into the index?
Yes, a sensitive instrument. Just like its inventor. Thanks. Drinks after work?
Sure.
I'll come get you in Jesus.
Heavenly.
So I worked on through that afternoon, heavily distracted by our evening's date and my vivid memory of her, enough to make me look temescently at the clock, wondering how this night would go and checking the tide and moon charts, and thinking of the river after dark, the Melville mood of the narrows at night, mysterious in moonlight. My IPPI's New York number had indeed dipped briefly at the news of this building collapse in Chelsea. But now it had stabilized and was even inching back up. A sensitive instrument indeed. The index and the derivatives we had concocted at water price to play on it were all booming in a most gratifying way. Helping our success was the fact that the continuous panicked quantitative easing since the second pulse had put more money out there than there was good paper to buy, which in effect meant that investors were, not to put too fine a point on it, too rich. That meant new opportunities to invest needed to be invented, and so they were. Demand gets supplied. And it wasn't that hard to invent new derivatives, as we had found out, because the floods had indeed been a case of creative destruction, which of course is capitalism's middle name. Am I saying that the floods, the worst catastrophe in human history, equivalent or greater to the 20th century's wars and their devastation, were actually good for capitalism? Yes, I am. That said, the intertidal zone was turning out to be harder to deal with than the completely submerged zone, counterintuitive though that might seem to people from Denver, who might presume that the deeper you are drowned, the deader you are. Not so. The intertidal, being neither fish nor fowl, alternating twice a day from wet to dry, created health and safety problems that were very often disastrous, even lethal. Worse yet, there were legal issues. Well-established law, going back to Roman law, to the Justinian Code, in fact, turned out to be weirdly clear on the status of the intertidal. It's crazy to read, like Roman futurology. The things which are naturally everybody's are air, flowing water, the sea, and the seashore. So nobody can be stopped from going on to the seashore. The seashore extends as far as the highest winter tide. The law of all peoples gives the public a right to use the seashore and the sea itself. Anyone is free to put up a hut there to shelter himself. The right view is that ownership of these shores is vested in no one at all. Their legal position is the same as that of the sea and the land or sand under the sea. Most of Europe and the Americas still followed Roman law in this regard, and some early decisions in the wake of the first pulse had ruled that the new intertidal zone was now public land. And by public, they meant not government land exactly, but land belonging to the unorganized public, whatever that meant. As if the public is ever organized, but whatever, redundant or not, the intertidal was ruled to be owned or unowned by the unorganized public. Lawyers immediately set to arguing about that, charging by the hour, of course. And this vestige of Roman law in the modern world had ever since been mangling the affairs of everyone interested in working in, by which I mean investing in, the intertidal. Who owns it? No one. Or everyone. It was neither private property nor government property, and therefore, some legal theorists ventured, it was perhaps some kind of return of the commons.
about which Roman law also had a lot to say, adding greatly to the hourly burden of legal opinionizing. But ultimately, the commons was historically a matter of common law, as seemed appropriate, meaning mainly practice and habit. And that made it very ambiguous legally, so that the analogy of the intertitle to a commons was of little help to anyone interested in clarity, in particular, financial clarity. So, how do you build anything in the intertitle? How do you salvage, restore, renew? How do you invest in a mangled, ambiguous zone still suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous tide flow? If people claim to own wrecked buildings that they or their legal predecessors used to own, but they don't own the land the buildings are on, what are those buildings worth? That's one of the things the IPPI did. It was a kind of specialized Case-Shiller index for intertitle assets. People loved having its number, which helped gauge investments of all kinds, including bets on the index's performance itself. Perhaps most importantly, it helped in calculating how much owners or ex-owners of intertitle properties had lost and could get compensated for, a number which Swiss Re, one of the giant reinsurance companies that insured all the other insurers, estimated to total worldwide at about $1,300 trillion. That's $1.3 quadrillion, but I think 1,300 trillion sounds bigger. $1,300 trillion. Well, but first of many firsts, in fact, that's far too low a valuation if you are trying to accurately price what the coastlines of the world are truly worth to humankind. If you don't heavily discount the future, which of course finance always does, the intertitle is worth about a zillion gazillion barillion dollars. Why say that? Because the future of humanity as a global civilization depends completely on its coastline presence. That's why. That being the case, the current wrecked zone also therefore represented an equal number of gazillion in losses. And yet no one knew who owned what, or on which side of the ledger any given asset resided. Were you in debt if you owned an asset stuck on a strand no one can own, or were you rich? Who knew? My index knew. And that was nice, because if the intertitle has any value at all, even if it's only a zillion or two, then someone wants to own that. And other people want to leverage that value right out to the usual 50 times whatever it might be. $50 zillion in leveraged opportunities, if only someone could put a plausible number on it, or, which is really the same thing, allow people to bet on what a plausible number might be, thus creating the value. That's what my index did. It was simple. Well, no, it wasn't simple. It took all the quants at my disposal to work it up, and all my quantitudicity to comprehend even what I was asking the quants to quant. But the basic idea was simple, and it was mine. I made judgments concerning how the various pieces of the puzzle impacted each other and the total situation, and boiled it all into that single index number, and assured everyone that it was an accurate assessment of the situation. I listed for inspection all the elements that went into the assessment and the basics of the calculation, which used classic Black-Scholes mechanisms for pricing derivatives, but beyond that, I did not give out the complete recipe of the algorithm, not even to Walter Price. I did let it be known that for my baseline I began with the same starting point as Case-Shiller, so the two indexes could be better compared, and for sure the spread between them was one of the things people liked to bet on. Case-Shiller had designated an 1890s housing price average as their normative 100, and rated prices since then relative to that baseline. Shiller afterward often pointed out that despite all the ups and downs of history, when adjusted for inflation, housing prices had never strayed far from where they had been in 1890. Even the biggest bubbles never took the index much over 140, and crashes seldom had gone below 95. So the IPPI took housing prices and simple sea level rise itself, and added to these two basics the following: an evaluation of improvements in intertidal construction techniques, an evaluation of the speed at which the existing stock was melting, a change in extreme weather violence factor derived from NOAA data, currency exchange rates, a rating of the legal status of the intertidal, and an amalgam of consumer confidence indexes, crucial here as everywhere else in the economy, although adding it to the IPPI was a new and controversial move on my part, as it was not a factor in the case Shiller. Using this mix of inputs, the IPPI said that in the years immediately after the second pulse, the submerged and intertidal's worth had case Shiller down to very near zero, as was only right. It was a devastated time. But that was a retroactive evaluation, and in the year we introduced the index, 2136, we calculated the number to be 47. And it had been rising, unsteadily but inexorably, ever since. That was another key to its success, of course. A long-term bull market makes rich geniuses of everyone involved. Yet another key was simply the name itself, Intertidal Property Pricing Index. Property. Get it? The name itself asserted something that before had been questionable. It was still questionable, but all over this world, property had already become somewhat liquefied. Property now was just a claim on the yield. So the name was a coup. Very nice. Reassuring. Comforting. So, currently the global IPPI was at 104, the New York regional at 116, and both were still trending up faster than the non-coastal case Shiller, which was now at 135. And in the end, it's growth, relative value, and differential advantage that matters in determining how well you are doing. So, yay for the IPPI. As for the instruments used for trading on the IPPI, that was just a matter of packaging and offering bonds for sale that went both long and short on the index. We were by no means the only ones doing that. It was a popular investment, with the multiple variables involved making it a volatile high-risk, high-return market, attractive to people who wanted that. Every week there was a splash and crash, as we called it, and then a new method of aerating the submarine world would be announced, something we called a prize and rise. Meanwhile, everyone had an opinion on how things were going and how they would go. And investors being so hungry for opportunities, the IPPI was performing well if judged simply by the number of bets being made on it. So well that it did even better in the classic sort of bandwagon jumping that drives the markets and maybe our brains too. It was doing so well that it did better. Of course, it was true that certain assumptions had baked into the IPPI needed to stay true for it to stay accurate. One was that the intertidal zone was going to remain legally ambiguous, jaundicing through the courts of Zeno-esque speed. Another was that not too many of these once and future and therefore present properties fell over too fast. If the rate of melting into the drink did not go exponential or nova, if it proceeded, even accelerating at a measurable rate that could be turned into a number that plotted not too hockey stickistically onto a graph, one could follow that trend line up or down and see other trends and hope to predict futures. And, yes, bet again on that, without the IPPI itself ever cratering even if the actual physical stock did. Thus, my index contained and then concealed some assumptions and analogies, some approximations and guesses. No one knew this better than I did, because I'm the one who made the choices when the quants laid out the choices for quantifying the various qualities involved. I just picked one. But this is what made it economics and not physics. Ultimately, the IPPI allowed for people, including Walter Price, to concoct derivative instruments that could be offered and bought. And these could then be bundled into larger bonds and sold again. So people loved the index and its numbers and did not examine its underlying logic too closely. New paper was valued in itself, especially when rated high by the rating agencies, who had such useful short memories, like everyone else in finance, when it came to their own absurdly terrible judgment, so the rating still mattered as a rubber stamp of legitimacy. Ridiculous though that was, given their history as a service bought by the very people they were rating. So now, as always, you could get AAA ratings, not for subprime mortgages, obviously bad, but for submarine mortgages, clearly much better. And the fact that all submarine properties were in some sense extremely subprime was not mentioned except as one aspect of the very lucrative risks involved. A new bubble, you might say, and you would be right. But people are blind to a bubble there inside. They can't see it. And that is very cool if you happen to have an angle of vision that allows you to see it. Scary, sure, but cool. Because you can hedge by way of that knowledge. You can, in short, short it. You can, as I had found out by doing it, invent a bubbleistic investment possibility more or less by accident, then sell it to people and watch it go long, knowing all the while that it is turning into a bubble, and all the while you can short it in preparation for the time that bubble pops. Spoofing? No. Ponzi scheme? Not at all. Just finance. Legal as hell. So, for the previous 6 months, reading the stats from around the coastlines of the world and trying to calculate all the trends, reading the tea leaves, the engineering journals, everything, including urban folk tales, I had come to believe that the moment was approaching when this bubble was going to pop. Some places, like good old Manhattan, had a huge influx of technological innovation and human capital and sheer money. And here we were going to uptake the intertidal and make the best of it. But most of the world was well off the leading edge in all these relevant areas, and as a result, their intertidal was melting faster than it was being renovated. It had been about 55 years since the second pulse began, 40 since it left off, and all over the world buildings were giving up the ghost and slipping under for good. Small buildings, big buildings, skyscrapers. Those last fell with a mighty splash, and the market flinched and shuddered in their wakes. Very brief flinches, just enough to adjust to the IPPI, playing the resulting jostle, and angle a few more points into our account. And then the bubble continued to expand. But it seemed like a moment of extreme simultaneous global badness was coming. And more I was shorting the very bubble I myself had helped to start in the first place. What could be more nerve-wrackingly cool? And I was going out with Jojo for Friday drinks, and then maybe afloat on the river, high tide at midnight, on a night of full moon. Perfect.
Oh, oh.
So I left work and hummed down to Eldorado Equity on Canal and Mercer. Turned onto Canal Canal, as the tourists love to hear it called. I found it crowded with afternoon traffic as usual, motorboats of every kind jammed bow to stern and thwart to thwart, to the point where more boat than water was visible. You could have walked across the canal on boat decks without ever having to jump, and quite a few flower sellers and mere passers-by were actually doing that. Jojo was waiting on her building's front dock, and I felt a little spike in the cardiograph. I kissed the dock side with the starboard side of the skater and said, "Hey there." "Hi," she said after a brief glance at her wrist, but I was on time, and she nodded as if in acknowledgement of that. She was graceful stepping along the deck back to the cockpit. Looking up at her from the wheel, it seemed like her legs went on forever. I was thinking of the Reef 40 Oyster Bar. "Sounds good," she said. "So do you have any champagne on this fine craft?" "Of course," I said. "What are we celebrating?" "Friday," she replied. "But also I made a little angel investment in some housing in Montana that seems like it should do very well." "Good job," I said. "I'm sure the people there will be very happy."
"Well, indeed. Security will do that."
"The champagne's in the refrigerator," I said. unless you want to take the wheel here.
Sure.
I ducked below and brought back up a split. It's all in splits, I'm afraid.
That'll do. We'll be to 40 pretty soon anyway.
True. We had both worked late as usual, and now with about a half hour of daylight left, I hummed the bug up West Broadway to 14th and turned west. As we purred along the sun-waked canal in the stream of boat traffic, I popped the split of champagne.
Very nice, she said after taking a sip.
The late sun spangled off the choppy water, shifting myriad blobs of brilliant orange over a deep black undercoat, the reflected light lancing everywhere. Yet another super Venice moment, and we toasted it as I let the bug putter along at the speed of traffic. The sunlight off the water suffused Jojo's face. It looked like we were on a stupendous stage in a play put on for the gods. Again, that feeling of I knew not what rose in the back of my throat as if my heart were swelling. I had to swallow hard. It was almost a kind of fear that I could feel this attracted to someone. What if you could really know someone? What if you could really get along? Then my pad played the first three notes of the Fanfare for the Common Man, and I growled and checked it before it occurred to me that I should just turn it off. But before I did, I saw the notice. That Chelsea Tower that had collapsed had killed scores of people, maybe hundreds. Oh, no, I said without time to stop myself.
What?
It's that building that went down in Chelsea. They're finding bodies.
Oh, no, indeed, she sipped her champagne. Did your IPPI come back up yet?
Mostly.
Do you want to go look at the damage?
I think I might have gaped for a second. I did want to go look, but then again I didn't. Because although it was important that I stay on top of intertidal developments and get out before the bubble popped, that pop wasn't going to happen just because this tower had done a Margaret Hamilton. And I was headed to the 40 Oyster Bar to watch the sunset with Jojo Bernal, and I didn't want her thinking that I wasn't giving her my top priority at this moment. But in the midst of this cogitation, she laughed at me.
Go ahead and go by, she said. It's almost on the way.
True.
And if you think it might be a trigger event, you only have to push a button to get out, right? You're prepped to move fast.
Nanoseconds, I said, proudly if inaccurately, and turned the bug up West Broadway. As we got up above 27th, it became a bit of a disadvantage to be in the bug, because its foils gave it a draft of almost 5 feet. Happily, it was just a couple of hours past high tide, which was all that allowed me to keep us headed uptown before I would have to cut west and out of the city. As we got closer to the crash site, the ordinary ammoniac reek of a tidal flat was joined by another smell, maybe creosote, with notes of asbestos, cracked wood, smashed brick, crumbled concrete, twisted rusty steel, and the stale air of moldy rooms broken open to the day like rotten eggs. Yes, a fallen intertidal building. They have a characteristic smell. I slowed down. The sunset poured its horizontal light over the scene, glazing the canals and buildings. A narrow bathtub ring marked all the buildings. Ah, yes, the intertidal, zone of uncertainty and doubt, space of risk and reward, the seashore that belonged to the unorganized public. Extension of the ocean, every building a grounded ship hoping not to break up. But now, one of them had. Not a monstrous skyscraper, just one of 4 20-story towers south of the old post office. Probably the use value and price of the other 3 had collapsed along with the one that had fallen, depending, of course, on if they could determine why it had happened. It was never easy to figure that out, making it a very objective correlative for the market itself. Often crashes just happened, responding to invisible stresses. I said as much to Jojo, and she grimaced and nodded. We hummed slowly up 7th, looking down the streets at the smash. No good would come from getting too close, as the canals around it were now dangerously reefed. This was obvious in the places where junk stuck up out of the water and strongly suggested where swirls and ripples and little white potato patches roiled the black water as the tide ebbed south through the neighborhood. Other parts of the canals would look fine and nevertheless be hull rippers. So I looked by approaching the smash from several canals in turn, proceeding as far as I felt safe and then turning back. The tower had obviously come down hard, pancaking maybe half its stories before spilling to the south and east. The shatter of its flat roof was tilted such that we could see all the water tanks and soil and greenery of the roof farm. Too much weight up there, probably, although that always was something that only became obvious in the aftermath. Emergency personnel were cautiously probing the wreckage from fireboats and police cruisers and the like, wearing the eye-popping yellows and oranges characteristic of disaster. Many smaller buildings had been crushed by the debris from the tower, and beyond those, many others were knocked aslant. Absent outer walls revealed rooms that were empty or furnished, but either way, pathetic.
"This whole neighborhood is wrecked,"
Jojo said. I could only nod.
"Lots of people must have died."
"That's what they said, although it looks like a lot of the brownstones were empty." I turned and motored us on toward 8th. "Let me think this over at Reef 40. I need a drink.
And some oysters."
"Sure." I piloted the bug up 8th, and as we passed 31st, I heard a shout.
"Hey, mister! Hey, mister! Help!"
It was the two kids I had almost run down south of the battery. "Oh, no," I said, and kept the throttle forward.
"Wait! Help! Help! Help!"
This was bad. I would have ignored them and hummed on anyway, but Jojo was watching me with a startled expression, surprised, no doubt, that I would just motor on, ignoring such a direct appeal. And the boys were holding up an old man between them, an old man who looked shattered and was not even as tall as they were, as if he had been cut off at the knees. They were all soaked, with mud streaking one boy's face. I cut the motor.
"Hey, what are you guys doing up here?"
"We got wrecked. Mr. Hexter's house got knocked over back there."
"Uh-huh," the taller one said.
"Our wrist pad got wet and stopped working, so we were walking to the Vapo. Hey, can we use your pad to make a call? Or can you give us a ride?"
the smaller and lippier one said. The old man between them just stared over his shoulder at his neighborhood, looking bereft.
"Is your friend okay?"
Jojo asked.
"I'm not okay," the old man exclaimed, without looking at her. "I lost everything. I lost my maps."
"What maps?" I asked.
"He had a collection," the smaller boy said. "All kinds of maps of the United States and all over, but mostly New York. But now he needs to get to somewhere." "Are you hurt?" Jojo asked.
The old man didn't reply.
"He's beat," the bigger boy said. "We've come a long way."
I saw the look on Jojo's face and said, "All right, get on board." They made a mess of my cockpit as well as my plans. I offered to take them back to the old man's building, thinking that with the evening already so muddied, I might as well go completely philanthropic, but all three of them shook their heads at once.
"We'll try and go back later," the smaller boy said. "For now, we need to get Mr. Hexter to where he can dry out and all."
"Where's that?" They shrugged.
"Back at the Met, maybe? Vlade will know what to do."
"You live in the Met on Madison Square?"
Jojo asked, looking surprised.
"Around there,"
the littler kid said, looking at her.
"Hey, you live in the Flatiron, right?"
"That's right."
"You do?" I said.
"That's right,"
she said again. "So we're neighbors," I said. "Did I know that?"
"I thought you did."
By now I was confused and thinking hard, and I'm sure it showed. Possibly I had not mentioned where I lived. We had mostly spoken about work,
and I hadn't known where she lived. After our night out on the Governor's Island Anchorage, I had dropped her off at her office at her request, assuming, I realized, that she lived in that building, and then I had boated home.
So, can I borrow your pad?
The littler kid asked Jojo. She nodded and held out her arm, and he tapped on it and then said,
Vlade, our pad got soaked, but can you let us dry off in your office, maybe? We have a friend whose building got knocked over.
I wondered if you guys were over that way, the super's voice said from Jojo's pad. Where are you now?
We're at 31st and 8th, but we got picked up by the guy with the zoomer who lives in your building.
Who's that?
The boys looked at us. Franklin Gar, I said.
Oh yeah, hi. I know who you are. So, can you bring them back to the building?
I glanced at Jojo and then said to the pad, We can bring them back. They have a friend with them who needs a little help, I'd say. His house got knocked around when the Chelsea Tower fell down this afternoon.
Sorry to hear. Someone I know?
Mr. Hexter, the littler kid said. We were there visiting him when it happened.
Okay, well, come on over and we'll see what we can do.
Sure, I said. See you there. So I headed the bug to Broadway and down the big canal through the early evening traffic to the Met, feeling balked but putting a good face on it. It was a sorry replacement for what I had had in mind for the evening, but what can you do? Our rescuees dripped blackly onto the floor of the cockpit, and the boat rode low in the water, tilting heavily as I guided it through the dense evening traffic on the canals. The rule for small boats was 3 hulls, 3 people, but not this evening. Finally, I idled across the Madison Square Bacino to the Met's boathouse door and waited for the super to wave us in. No desire to piss him off with this menagerie aboard. He poked his head out and nodded.
Come on in. You boys looked like drowned rats.
We saw a bunch of rats swimming away. This big building next to Mr. Hexter's place melted, and the wave knocked us sideways.
The super shook his head lugubriously, as was his way.
Roberto and Stefan, spreaders of chaos.
They liked this.
Can you put Mr. Hexter in one of the temporaries? One of them asked. He needs to get warmed up and cleaned up. Get some food and rest, right, Mr. H?
The old man nodded. He was still in a fog. It made sense. People squatting in the intertidal were usually at the end of their options. The super was shaking his head.
We're full, you know that. Charlotte's the only one to talk about that.
As always, the smaller boy said.
Jojo looked like she was kind of enjoying all this, but I couldn't see why.
She'll be back in an hour or so, the super said. Meanwhile, there's the bathrooms off the dining room. You could clean up there. And I'll see if Heloise can rustle up a place for him, if Charlotte says it's okay.
I hummed into the boathouse and everyone got off on the interior landing. The kids led their ancient friend up the stairs toward the dining hall, and I looked at Jojo.
We could take off, I suggested.
Since we're already here, she said, I'd like to go over to the Flatiron and change. Then maybe eat here? I'm kind of tired.
All right, I said, feeling uneasy. She was definitely not in the same mood she had been in when I picked her up, and I wasn't sure why. Something about the kids, the old man, me. It was spooky. I wanted her to be like she had been last time, but there was nothing to do but go along and hope. I let the super hang up my boat to get it out of the way, asking him to put it where I could get to it fast this evening, thinking that Jojo might still change her mind. The super just pursed his lips and got the bug into his crane sling without replying. I didn't know what the other residents saw in him. If it were up to me, he'd be fired yesterday. But it wasn't up to me, because I couldn't be bothered to waste time dealing with the building's many boards and committees. I got enough of trading at work and was happy to just rent an apartment in a nice building overlooking a bacino I liked that was not too near where I worked, so I could get a Zoom in on a daily basis. I could more than afford the non-co-op member surcharge, even though this was shamelessly massive, a hit designed to gouge non-compliants like me. I sometimes hoped someone would challenge this dual price arrangement in court. It struck me as highly prejudicial and possibly illegal, but no one had done it so far, and it occurred to me as I waited for Jojo to come back from the Flatiron, fuming at the way the evening was going, that anyone who cared enough to waste their time challenging this rule would be too poor to rent in the building in the first place. They were price selecting for wealthy indifference from their non-member rentals, a smart move, probably the plan of the board chairwoman, a notorious social justice warrior both at work and here at home, a control freak in the same class as the super, a woman who had been running the board and thus the building for I wasn't sure how long, but far too long. She had been chair when I arrived. Naturally, she and the super were buddy-buddy. And lo and behold, here she was herself, in conversation with the boys and the old man, Charlotte Armstrong, looking frazzled and intense, vivid and imposing. My day was complete. I followed them all into the dining room, keeping back so I didn't have to join them any sooner than necessary. But then Jojo appeared at the common room entry, having walked over on the sky bridges linking us to One Madison and then the Flatiron, or so I presumed. She headed for the boys before she even saw me, so there was no choice but to follow and join them. I said hi, and the chairwoman was quite nice to me, in a way that Jojo noticed. I had to lift my eyebrows innocently and then admit that it was true. I had once again saved the wharf rats from a dismal fate. "Shall we eat?" I asked, being ravenous, and some of us nodded, while others kept asking the now homeless old man from Chelsea how he was feeling. Chairwoman Charlotte and Jojo followed me to the food windows in the dining hall, and I flashed my meat card to the clerk while listening to the two women talking. They were sounding fairly stiff and uncomfortable. City social worker and financier. Not a great match. Around us in the line were many faces I knew and many I didn't. Too many people lived in the building to actually get to know anybody, even if many faces became familiar. The clerk zapped my meat card and I went to the tray of carnitas and filled a tortilla and rolled it. You had to work for any meat you ate in this dining hall. It was a way to create a lot of vegetarians and leave enough meat for the rest of us, because few could stomach, ha ha, raising a piglet to food age and then killing it, even with the superhumane zappers we have, essentially an instantaneous lights out. Lots of people go anthropomorphic and decide it's easier to eat fake meat or become vegetarian, or eat out when they want meat. I myself had found by direct experimentation that the unavoidable anthropomorphizing of the farm's pigs had no restraining effect on my fatal hand, because if you think of a pig as a human, it is a really ugly human and probably appreciates you putting it out of its misery. So I usually thought of them as the super, or my uncle, and enjoyed the taste of them later in the week. Not a qualm as I chomped, as really I have done them nothing but favors, from farm to fork, from birth to mouth. They wouldn't even have existed without me and the rest of the carnivores around me, and had had a great couple of years along the way. Better than many humans in this city got. Eating meat again? Jojo asked as we met at the salad bar. Yes, I am. Do you do the qualification thing on the meat floor of the farm here? I do. It definitely makes it more real, more of a commitment. Kind of like being a trader, don't you think?
No, I don't.
Just joking. And of course it was quite stupid of me to joke about our biz given the way the evening was going, but all too often I can shoot before aiming, especially in the hours after a long day in front of the screen. I finish those sessions and my sense of discipline relaxes, and then odd things can come out of my mouth. On many evenings I've noticed that, so I reminded myself to be cool on this night, and followed Jojo back to our table, entranced again by the set of her shoulders, the fall of her hair. Damn those boys, anyway. We reconvened at a single table, the boys and their ancient friend, Jojo and Charlotte the chairperson, the super, whose name was Vlade, very apropos, Vlade the Impaler, face like a Ukrainian executioner, and me. It was just a couple too many people to be able to have a single conversation easily, not least because there were a few hundred more people in the big dining hall, and it was therefore noisy, especially since a group in the corner was playing Reich's Music for 18 Musicians by clacking a set of variously sized spoons and singing wordlessly. Still, everyone started by asking the old man how he was feeling, and Charlotte, hearing his story and squinting unhappily as she no doubt contemplated our building's non-existent or even negative vacancy rate, offered him a temporary place to stay. Until you can get back into your place or find something more suitable.
Can't he just stay here?
The littler kid asked her. Charlotte said, We're full right now, that's the problem. And there's a waiting list too, so all I can really do is offer one of the temporary spaces. Even those are full, and not that comfy over the long haul.
Better than nothing, said the littler one.
He was Roberto, I was learning. Either Roberto or Stefan.
Is his own building a goner? I asked, to show interest.
The old man winced. The taller of the two boys, this was probably Stefan, said,
It's tilted like diagonal.
The old man groaned at this. He was still shell-shocked. Can I get you a drink? I asked him. Jojo didn't seem to notice this, but Charlotte gave me a grateful look as I rose. I was certainly going to refill my own glass, too. The old man nodded as I picked up his glass.
Red wine, thanks, he said.
He would learn to avoid the red if he stayed here more than a couple of days, but only by experiencing its mouth-puckering tannins directly. So I nodded and walked over to fill his glass and refill mine with the Vinho Verde. Both were from the Flatiron small roof vineyard, which spilled picturesquely down both of its long sides, but their Verde was so much finer than their rotor gut. I came back with both hands full and asked, Anyone else while I'm up? But they were listening to the old man describe his building's meltdown and only shook their heads.
The main thing is to get my maps,
he concluded, looking at the boys flanking him.
They're in cabinets in my living room. I've got a copy of the headquarters map and a whole bunch of others. They can't get wet, so the sooner the better.
We'll go tomorrow,
Roberto told him, with a little head shake to his ancient friend that said, Don't talk about this now. I wondered what that could be about. Possibly they didn't want Vlade thinking about them going back to the intertitle. Indeed, the super was frowning, but the taller boy saw this and said,
Come on, Vlade. We're there every day.
It will have a completely different bottom now that building has melted, he said.
We know. We'll be careful.
They kept reassuring him and the old man. Meanwhile, Charlotte and Jojo were getting acquainted.
And what do you do? Jojo asked.
Charlotte frowned.
I work for the Householders Union.
So, doing the same thing you're doing for Mr. Hexter here?
Pretty much. How about you?
I work at Eldorado Equity.
Hedge fund?
That's right.
Charlotte did not look impressed. She made a quick reappraisal of Jojo, then looked back at her plate.
Is that interesting?
I think so. I've been financing the rebuilding in Soho. It seems to be going really well. I wouldn't be surprised if some of your people have been housed there. It has a low-income element. And up until a year ago, it was just a shell, like most of that neighborhood. It takes investment to bring a drowned neighborhood back out of the drink.
Indeed,
Charlotte said, squinting slightly. She seemed willing to entertain the notion, which made sense, considering her job. The city was always going to need more housing than it had, particularly in the submerged zone. Wait, I hear you sounding kind of positive about investment finance, I said. I need to get this on pad. Charlotte gave me a dirty look, but Jojo's was even worse.
I focused on the old man. You're looking pretty tired, I told him. Would you like some help getting to your room?
We haven't worked out where that is yet, Charlotte said.
So maybe we better, I said. She gave me a look that indicated she was not rolling her eyes, only by dint of extreme muscular control. I smiled. The hotel in the farm? I suggested.
Isn't that a crime scene? Vlade asked.
Charlotte shook her head.
They've done what they need to there. Jen told us we could use it again. But does it stay warm in those?
My room was freezing, the old man said. I don't care about that.
Okay, then, Charlotte said. That would be easiest, for sure.
The boys were looking at each other uneasily. Possibly they didn't want to be tasked with being their friend's roommates. Charlotte seemed unaware of their unease. Possibly they lived in or around this building without her knowing about it. Now was not the time to ask them. I was getting the feeling that nothing I could say at this table was going to go over well, and it seemed like my best option was to eat and run, with a good excuse, of course. My plate was empty, and so was the old man's, and he did look beat. I'll help you get up there, I said, standing up. Come on, boys. Their plates had been empty seconds after they sat down to them. You can finish what you began. Vlade nodded at them and joined us as we headed toward the elevators, leaving the two women behind. I would have given a lot to be a fly on the wall for that conversation, but it was not to be, and if I had been present, the conversation would not have been the same. So with a qualm, I passed by Jojo and said, "See you later." She frowned.
"I'm tired. I'll probably just go home in a while."
"All right," I said. "I'll come back down when I'm done, see if you're still here."
"I'll be up in a bit," Charlotte said. "I want to see how things look up there."
So the evening was screwed, and in fact it had been going badly most of the night, judging by Jojo's face, and that was worrying me quite badly. Adjustments were going to have to be made, but which ones, and why?
Part 3. Liquidity Trap. Drowned, hosed, visiting Davy Jones, 6 fathoms under, wet, all wet, moldy, mildewed, tidal, marshy, splashing, surfing, body surfing, diving, drinking, in the drink, drunk, damp, scubaed, plunged, high diving, sloshed, drunk, doused, watered, waterfalled, snorkeled, running the rapids, backstroking, waterboarded, gagged, holding your breath, in the tube, bath escaping, taking a bath, showered, swimming, swimming with the fishes, visiting the sharks, conversing with the clams, lounging with the lobsters, joying with Jonah, in the belly of the whale, pilot fishing, leviathanating, getting finny, schnockered, dipped, clammed, clamming, salting, brined, belly flopping, trawling, bottom feeding, breathing water, eating water, down the toilet, washing machined, submarining, going down on Mother Ocean, sucking it, sucking water, breathing water, H2O-ing, liquidated, liquefied, aplastadoed, drenched, poured, squirted, pissed on, peed out, golden showered, Pluto-sucking, estuaried, immersed, emulsified, shelled, oystered, squeegeed, melted, melting, infinity-edged, depth-charged, torpedoed, inundated, laved, deluged, fluvialized, fluviated, flooded, Noah'd, Noah's neighborhood, U-boating, universally solventized, ad aqua infinitum.
A. The Citizen. The first pulse was not ignored by an entire generation of ounce brains. That is a myth. Although, like most myths, it has some truth to it, which has since been exaggerated. The truth is that the first pulse was a profound shock, as, how could it not be, raising sea level by 10 feet in 10 years. That was already enough to disrupt coastlines everywhere, also to grossly inconvenience all the major shipping ports.